He and his wife have retired and elected to come to Savannah.
Doug.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, what is, recording. So, I have what I'm going to say on this, but I'm not so trusting, so I have it on this too. I've lost too many things on that, so. Okay. So Fred asked me to sit down and think about my life and what's happened in my life and give you all a snapshot of my journey and how I got to where I am today. So it's caused me to sit down and do a lot of thinking about what happened in my life. And so I'm happy to share this with you all. So to start with, I was born in 1957 in a town called Ventura in California. I don't know if many of you know where Ventura is. It's on the beach about 60 miles northwest of Los Angeles. It was a great place to grow up, but I actually lived in a little hamlet of Oakview, which was kind of up the valley from Ventura. And when I was 9, my parents moved actually into Ventura proper. But I'm a middle child of 3 brothers, each of us about 2 years apart. Now, that's my siblings, my mother and father. My mother was raised as a Catholic. By means of a background, she was raised a Catholic by her 6 sisters. She was one of 7 sisters. Her mother died when she was 2, and she grew up kind of all over the place, but her sisters in the end raised her. She was distanced from the church from about 12 years old on because she was moving around. So my mother was born to the point that she was in that 12-year to 18-year-old age group when World War II was going on. So during World War II, all of her sisters lived in Los Angeles. They worked at the Douglas Aircraft Factory as riveters and mechanics and assemblies. And my mom and 2 of her sisters were too young. So they were just home alone. When the war is over, all the guys come back. All the sisters are looking for husbands, or all the guys are looking for wives. I'm not sure which way it went. But they start getting married. And then at this 2-bedroom house that they live in for 6 sisters, all of a sudden there's husbands and so on and so forth living in there. So they all kind of split up and disperse from there. And my mother went with one of her sisters to live with her. And that sister was fortuitous, and that sister was a Lutheran at the time. So that was a connection there. But let me get to that. My mom had a fairly rough life. Her mother died when she was 2. Her father rejected her, didn't want anything to do with her. And so she was adopted by an aunt at the age of 3, an aunt and uncle at the age of 3. And they gave her up at the age of 5. They said, we don't want her anymore. Take her away. It's because they had their own children at that point in time. They adopted my mother because they didn't have any children. They had a child. They didn't want my mother anymore. So my mother's grandmother took her back to Los Angeles to her sisters. And again, that's where she grew up with them. So she had no attention, no real direction in her life. And she just kind of stumbled around here and there. No real religious background other than they went to the Catholic Church when they could, when everybody was off work. My father was an only child. He was raised in a religious background with my grandmother and grandfather. But by the age of about 17, my father was really an atheist when it came right down to it. He wanted nothing to do with religion in any stretch, any form, any way. And so he forced this on my mother when my mother and father were married. He forced this on my mother. And of course, then with my mother and father, it was kind of forced on my brothers and I as well. My grandparents did not really get involved with us at that point in time because my father was kind of, well, let's just say he was mean. He was just mean about the whole thing. So my grandparents just stayed out of it. And that's where my parents were in the backgrounds from them. As it happened, as I said, one of my aunts, my mom's oldest sister, she was an active practicing Lutheran. And when we were very young, she would pick us up occasionally and take us to the Lutheran church, my brothers and I. This is usually when my father was preoccupied with something or was not around to say no. And we would go to the church with her, and we did this maybe 6, 7, 8 times a year. But I would say one point to note was that my brothers and I were all kind of embarrassed by this because we were teased by the regular churchgoers because we didn't know anything. Okay, we had no religious background at home. When we went to the church, we didn't know the Bible. We didn't know the Bible stories and things like that, and we were teased about it. So there's no real drive in any of us, my brothers and I, to continue going. We simply went because my aunt said, you're going to church. So that was what happened, okay? Okay, then when I was about 9 years old, at this point, my family moved to Ventura, and that was quite a distance from where my aunt lived, so the going to the Lutheran church at some point in time basically stopped at that point in time. And so from the time of I was about 9 till I was about 16, I had absolutely no religious influence at all, no church going, no nothing. With my father being an atheist, my mother being an obedient wife, I should say, we had nothing, okay? And I said that was till about 16, because in high school, at 16, I met a guy in high school, a good friend of mine, who was a practicing Christian. And he worked on me very hard to try to get me back into the church. But my father really kind of stopped this. He was very toxic in his attitude. He was, and he made us feel bad. So his actions and were hurtful to us and ostracizing to us. So I kind of stopped in any church going with this friend of mine I had in high school. So in high school, I was a good student. I participated in athletics, participated in all the shop classes, worked a job in a grocery store, helped my father as a mechanic on heavy construction equipment, and basically had no time for anything else. So there was no time for doing Christian activities, church, or even seeing people and friends very much. We fixed equipment on Sundays. My father had a fleet of construction equipment, bulldozers, scrapers, motor graders, things like that. And my brothers and I were basically the mechanic crew for him, which was a fun job. It got us all together. But again, we were completely removed from anything on Sundays except for doing this sort of thing. If we wanted a car when we turned 16, we had to earn our own money to buy the car and pay the insurance and the bills for that. So, of course, then I got a job in a grocery store, as I said previously, working to earn enough money to buy a car, pay the insurance, pay the gas, pay the maintenance and things like this on it. So I had that part-time job. By the same token, my parents insisted on a college education for my brothers and I. And unfortunately, they could only afford to put my older brother through the college. And so myself and my younger brother had to pay our own way. Well, in California, if you went to a community college, it was basically the cost of books and some attendance fees. And if you went to a state university, some of them were manageable, affordable, but some of them were not. I wanted a degree in ocean engineering because I was interested in engineering and the marine environment. And so schools that I would select to go to, they were a little bit more expensive. So that was a bit of a problem. So going on from there, working in the grocery store that I was in, some people that were customers in the grocery store found out about my interest in engineering and in the marine environment, and they recommended me for a job at a company called Vetco that was in Ventura. Vetco was the very first offshore oil field equipment company. They manufactured the equipment required to drill offshore and floating vessels and fixed jackup vessels. So they were pretty unique in this company in this manner. Heavy in the engineering and basically spread all over the world very quickly because the oil field is all over the world. So I was recommended for this job. I went down and did an interview, and lo and behold, they hired me. I'm not sure why at the time, but they hired me. And I started off as a forklift driver, but after about 8 weeks as a forklift driver, I was on a machine tool. I ran lathes, milling machines, and things like that as a machinist in this oil field equipment company. The problem was, this was a full-time job. And so I worked night shift from 4 o'clock in the afternoon till 2 o'clock in the morning, and I went to school from 8 o'clock in the morning till 1 o'clock in the afternoon. There was no time. There was no sleep. There was nothing. So I did this for 2.5 years, working to earn the money to go off to the university. Well, even after 2.5 years, I really didn't have everything I needed. So I took a chance and went to the founder of this company. It was a publicly held company at this point in time, but the founder was still active in the business. So I went to the founder and said, "Are there any scholarships?" And to my surprise, he said, "What do you need? Where are you going and what are you doing?" And I told him, and he says, "I will cover at least half of it for you." And he says, "If you get stuck, let me know." So he said, "This does not mean you have to come back and work for Vetco. But he says, if you do, if you want to, you have a guaranteed job." So I thought, this is a pretty good way to go. So I went off to college, okay, in an engineering school, as Fred said, Florida Atlantic University, and I got a degree in ocean engineering. And I came back to VETCO as a design engineer for them after 2.5 years at FAU. Okay, and let's see, I missed something here.
You missed who you met there.
Yeah, I'll get to that. I'll get to that. But it was during the time that I was working at VETCO as a machinist that I believe the Lord spoke to me. Now, let me jump back a little bit on that. When the manufacturing guys at this company found out what I was doing, that I was going off to university, coming back as an engineer, they formulated a plan. So they kind of extracted me from the machinist job and put me in every department of the company, including finance and sales. So I had experience throughout the entire company. This is in the last 6 months that I was working for them. And at the time, I didn't really ask why, but now that I stand up here and think about it, I know why. They wanted me back to do things for them, and that's exactly what they did. So I was rotated around these departments before going to university and got all this experience, which was great experience. So not only in machining and welding and assembly and finance and sales and service and all this kind of stuff, I had a little bit of knowledge of all those things. And at the age of 19, 20 years old, that's a pretty good experience. You don't get that very often. So it was a lot of experience in a very short time. So during this time that I was working for them, though, as I said, I feel that the Lord spoke to me, and I knew in my heart that I needed to go to Singapore. And I thought, well, Singapore, where is Singapore? I don't even know where it's at for some reason. So I found it on the map and looked at it and thought, that's interesting. But I just kind of wrote it off at the time because it just didn't make any sense to me. Here I was working as a machinist or in this manufacturing part, and they wanted me to go to Singapore. I felt I needed to be in Singapore. It just didn't jive. So as I look back, though, it seems the events just came together at this point, and as I grew in knowledge of the Lord, I realized His hand was in this all along, because it was everything from working with my dad as a mechanic, so I had the basic knowledge, the people that were the customers in the grocery store that recommended me to the job to get into this company, and then within the company, the manufacturing guys taking me and moving me around, and then knowing somehow that I needed to be in Singapore. So to get to Singapore, we'll go on with the story here a little bit, and then we'll come back to that. So I went to Florida to do my upper-level college work, and that's where I met Michelle, my wife, and we met in an ocean chemistry class because she was a chemistry major, and I'm an engineering major. It's like, well, those two things don't ever mix. Well, in ocean chemistry, they did, so that's where we met each other. Michelle was a strong, practicing Christian in a non-denominational church. And with my lack of a Christian background, this led to difficulties. We didn't share common beliefs and certainly not faith of any way. And I should note that Michelle was raised Catholic, but left the Catholic Church of her own accord in her teenage years to go to a non-denominational church that was associated or founded by Derek Prince. Does anybody know that name? Derek Prince? Okay. So he's the founder of the church that she went to in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. So we had issues with her parents because her parents were Catholic, and she was kind of forced to go to the Catholic Church, but she wanted to be in this non-denominational church. We had issues with her friends and their parents who had went with her to the non-denominational church and were telling her, no, don't date this guy. He's not Christian. You should stay away from him and all this kind of stuff. And then between ourselves, we had issues because she's a believer. I'm a non-believer. I'm ignorant, I should say, at that point in time about Christianity. But in the end, the Lord's hand managed all these difficulties and issues, and we were married just before we graduated in 1980. And I always figured Michelle saw something in me that made her take a chance with me, even though I wasn't a Christian, and I asked her about that. She says it was because I was an honorable, trustworthy person, and she saw promise in me. So if you see Michelle, you can say, did you really see promise in him, huh? So we graduated in June 1980, moved back to Ventura, where I took up the engineering job with VETCO, and Michelle followed 4 months later when she graduated, because she didn't graduate at the same time. She was actually on a research vessel in the Gulf of Mexico for 4 months, and during that time, she wasn't attending classes, so she had to make up one additional semester. So we didn't attend church when we went to California after Michelle arrived, because I had little knowledge of the churches in Ventura, and we were both so busy settling in, getting jobs started, and so on and so forth, that we didn't feel we had time for it. To be honest, that was probably a cop-out. There was always time. It was easier not to do it because it was unfamiliar to me, and so on and so forth. When I had gone back to Vetco and taken up the job in engineering, the manufacturing guys found out about it, and they requested me to work part-time in the manufacturing area, fixing engineering issues. And if any of you have been in manufacturing and engineering and manufacturing, you know engineers do this, manufacturing guys do this, and there's this wall between them sometimes. It's like, hey, you guys, can you change this so I can do this easier? And so I did a lot of that. I did a huge amount of that sort of thing, sorting out the issues within the company because I had a foot in both sides. I knew how to make it. I knew how to design it. So it was unique that I could come in and do this sort of thing. So they had me about half time, if you will. I would go to work in the morning. I'd spend half a day in the manufacturing side, half a day in the engineering side, trying to and sorting out things in manufacturing, doing new design in the engineering, and so on. So it was an invaluable learning experience. I think that was one of the best things that ever happened to me as far as my career goes, was to have that unique ability to be in both areas. So in addition to doing this stuff in manufacturing, my job in engineering, I was assigned engineering projects for the China National Oil Company and the China Geological Survey Company, which were the original drilling companies in China, okay? So I did the work for them, and I could see doing this work for them, things were beginning to fall into place because these two customers were actually customers of the Singapore facility. Okay, but I'm doing the engineering work in California in Ventura for this because the Singapore facility had no engineering at the time. So things are starting to move a little bit. So these projects that I did and my work for the manufacturing guys caught the eye of the vice president that was in Singapore facility, and he asked for me to attend the design review in China. So this is late 1982 that we did the design review in China. Well, I'm not sure if any of you have been to China very much. 1982, China had just opened. So there's one hotel to stay in Shanghai. There's one restaurant to eat. You stayed in the car with your minders, if you will, and you did everything by the book with them in that time. But it was still a unique experience to go there in 1982 and to see what was going on and to be involved and so on. So after I went to China and did the design review, I came back to Singapore and for a couple of days, and the VP that was there, he asked me to transfer to Singapore as soon as possible. So 2 months later, Michelle and I are moving to Singapore, and at this point in time, Michelle is 6 months pregnant, okay? So she's moving halfway around the world, 6 months pregnant. Her mother and father said, "Are you crazy? What are you doing?" And her coworker she had said the same thing. Well, we did it anyway, and we get to Singapore, and Michelle's well taken care of by the Singapore employees and their wives. In other words, we had both expatriate employees and local Singaporean employees, but because she's coming in pregnant, they really band together and took care of her for all the things medical and so on and so forth, and that was a great help. So she's got this ever-enlarging group of friends that she knows that are helping around with her pregnancy and with everything moving in and so on. And so, park that to the side. So we get to Singapore and we start looking for different churches in Singapore, but none of them felt right. It just did not feel like home when we went to them. We did not feel welcome. And I think that was an important point. When you go into a new church and you don't feel like you belong there, you don't feel welcome, you're not inclined to come back for a second time. And I think that's an important lesson that I've always kept in mind since I went through that myself. But finally, one of the ever-increasing circle of people that Michelle was meeting with, helping her out, and a woman by the name of Darlene Wheeler, asked us to attend St. George's Church. And we did this, and we felt right. We found a church home. And many of the people who helped Michelle also attended St. George's. So the welcome was immediate and comfortable. You just walk in, you knew people. They spoke to you. "Hey, come sit with me. Hey, this is what the service is doing," so on and so forth, and help guide you through everything. It was really, like I said, really welcoming. You just fit right in and you just felt at home. So the welcome we received did so much to draw us in and to keep us there. So the preaching was also very good. The Sunday school for the children, the fellowship was all great. So everything just kind of combined together to get us there. Now, St. George's is an Anglican church aligned, Craig, make sure I get this right, with Global South.
Right.
Okay. And the ACNA. So they all will come together. In other words, they were the correct Anglican church. I guess that's the best way to put it. And it was about half expatriates and about half locals. And in the church, and it was generally had an expatriate vicar. In other words, the vicar is the same as the rector that we have here. And so those expatriate vicars, as they call them there, were either English, British, Australian, South African. We had one American at the time that I was there. Okay. So the Anglican Church in Singapore also uses, besides a vicar, they have what's called a curate. Okay, a curate is, well, like Joe is here, I guess. I'm not sure about that. But anyway, he was the second priest there. And the Anglican Church in Singapore is established by the Act of the British Parliament in the late 1800s. So to a certain extent, it shares some commonality with CCA originally being established here in Georgia. In other words, there's an Act of Parliament that got it there. And it was built, the cathedral in Singapore, St. Andrew's, was built on land granted by the British Crown. And St. George's was started as a British garrison church. In other words, the British maintained a garrison in there. St. George's was a garrison church. Okay, during World War II, it was a Japanese ammunition dump, and so on and so forth. But in other words, it was a garrison church that was there. When Singapore got its independence, and then the British forces moved out, this would be in the middle to late 60s, St. George's was handed over to the cathedral. And then it was established as a public church, okay? The military base that was around it was reconfigured, and the Singaporean forces took over the military base, but the church was left out of it so the church could be a public entity. Because we had the number of different vicars and so on leading the church, we had a lot of different leadership examples that we saw, and everything from really dull British to excited Australian to sport-loving South Africans and to the one American who was just, as I look at it now, I think he was overwhelmed by what he got into. So anyway, these leadership examples were all very good. But when we first started St. George's, the vicar there, a guy named John Benson, was a firm believer in small groups. He thought that was a very important way to get everybody involved in the church and to expand the reach of the church into the community. Because he said, if you've got small groups, the small groups can do this project, and small groups can do that project. Similar to Fred, to what you said about this men's group taking on some ministry or something like that. He was very much a believer in that sort of thing. During John Benson's time, Renes Panaya was a curate, and eventually would go on to be the bishop of the province of Southeast Asia. Now, some of you may know that name, Renes Panaya. I think he's been here a couple of times, I'm not sure. But I know that Clark and Carol Smith know him. They met him a number of times when they were in Singapore. Anyway, he was a really good guy. In fact, Renes also pushed the small groups, maybe more than John Benson did. And in fact, he was in the small group that Michelle and I eventually joined. And after a while, we took over the leadership of that small group. But I'm getting a little ahead of myself there. After joining St. George's and having attended for some time, Michelle was asked to help out in the Sunday school, which she did, and she started teaching the 4 to 5 to 6-year-old group. And as for me, I had a lot of catch up and learning to do because I had no Christian basis to start with. But a guy named Scott Sundquist, who was a professor at the Trinity Bible College in Singapore, he kind of latched on to me and mentored me. And I thought, why is he doing this? Well, I found out, but anyway. And he got me involved in helping to teach Sunday school for teenagers. Now, I had met Scott because he had a son that was the same age as my son on the baseball team together. So that was where the connection came from. But others encouraged me along the way as well. But what a way to learn fast and have to be on your toes teaching Sunday school to high schoolers. For crying out loud, when they all got together, they could just snow you with questions and you just couldn't keep up. So you had to be on your toes. You had to know your lesson. You had to know the scripture. You had to know the Bible. So it forced me to be prepared and be prepared in a hurry. Okay? I still very much enjoy teaching teenagers because they come up with solid and unique questions that sometimes I couldn't answer, but you said, okay, I'll find out the answer and come back to you on that. I don't really know right now. But you can see their minds are working. And so I think Sunday school for high schoolers is a really interesting thing to do, really interesting class to teach. After 2 years, Scott and his family moved back to the USA, and he volunteered me. Notice that he volunteered me. I didn't volunteer, but he made me volunteer to take over the high school group of Sunday school, which I did. And I ended up teaching that high school group until my oldest daughter graduated from university or from high school. So I guess I taught that for probably 12 years or 13 years, the high school group. Okay. During this time, Michelle and I participated in small group Bible studies, and due to the expatriate community, people moving in and out, small groups were forever changing. In other words, you'd establish a small group, you might have 10, 12, 14 people, but in a year, you might have a turnover of six of those people at any time because expatriates were being transferred in and out as companies moved them to other jobs and so on and so forth. So it was forever changing. Okay, so the teaching of the high school group combined with the small group Bible studies that we did and the regular church services kind of just sucked me right into the Christianity. And somewhere in that time, around 1988, I came to faith in the Lord. I came to faith. And it was a gradual affair, if you will. It wasn't an instantaneous thing. But I realized in 1998 I was a believer, and I was had faith, and I started developing it from there. But at this point, I must say I found the small groups sometimes less than helpful, as they lacked a clear structure both in the actual meaning as well as the subject matter. Many times we were studying books or pamphlets or themes or interpreting somebody else's opinion or commentary with comments, conclusions, and directions I didn't always agree with. And so there are many opinions, but there are no right or wrong answers, and we weren't directly studying the Word. And that's what I want to do. I wanted to study the Word, because you hear all the time, well, the Bible says this. So I go looked at him and said, that's not what I think it says. And so I wanted to get to be more and more involved directly into the Word. So to carry on, we stayed in St. George's our entire life, we stayed at St. George's our entire time in Singapore for 38 years. And both Michelle and I teaching Sunday school. We stepped down, as I said, when my oldest daughter graduated from high school. And Michelle also stopped soon after that. She then got involved in the music ministry, playing the violin, which she does here at CCA. You see her up in the folk group playing. And she very much enjoys doing that. And I very much encourage her to do that, because I love to hear the violin playing with the piano. For myself, after stopping the Sunday school, I was asked to serve on the parish council, and I did that for 1 year, and the next year they asked me to run or to be elected as the people's warden for the church. Now, here in the States, I don't know that you have people's warden and vicar's wardens?
More or less.
Kind of the same thing? Okay, so I was the people's warden, and I ended up being the people's warden for about 12 years. And at the same time, I also went through what's called the lay reader training in Singapore. In Singapore, because there's a distinct shortage of clergy, you usually have the vicar and you have a curate. Sometimes you only have the vicar. And then you have the lay readers that do everything else. So at any one time, there might be only one priest in the church. So the lay readers, we would do the readings, we would do the prayers, the intercessions, lead the Nicene Creed, all this kind of stuff we did as lay readers. The only thing we didn't do was a sermon and the actual officiating of communion. Though I'll have to say, I had to do communion a couple times because the visiting priest didn't show up. It's like, what's going on here? So fortunately, when that happened, I did the communion, but there's usually another guy serving that actually could step up and give a sermon.
And Doug, let me say this. Up until probably about 30 years ago, the term lay reader was what was used here.
Okay.
There was no term Eucharistic minister or lector or anything like that.
Okay. All right. So again, there's commonality in a lot of things like that. So anyway, I did my training as a lay reader, and I was licensed by the bishop and did that until we actually transferred out of Singapore in June 2020 and came back here to Savannah. So during this time when we were there, Michelle started also homeschooling our two daughters when our oldest daughter was in junior high school. So I'm not sure if you all have girls, but junior high school girls can be downright mean. And my oldest daughter had a difficulty with this, and so my wife decided to homeschool. In the process of doing the homeschool, she met other homeschooling mothers, and these other homeschooling mothers did Bible studies as well. And so Michelle got involved in those. And these Bible studies happen to be precept ministry Bible studies, which follows kind of a set format in the way they do things. So Michelle introduced this to me, and I thought, this is what I'm looking for. Because remember I said earlier, we do these Bible studies, but I really wasn't comfortable because we weren't studying the Word directly. We weren't discerning what we should be discerning. We didn't know right from wrong. We didn't get things right all the time. So we started with the precept, and I started attending the precept classes as well, the precept Bible studies in a small group. So eventually, we created our own small group, Michelle and I, and we had a precept class, and we ran that for probably close to 20 years in Singapore. And to me, it was very encouraging because, like I said, we studied the Word directly, and that was what I wanted to do. I wanted to know, what does the Bible say to me and to everybody, to all of us? What do those words mean on that? So there are many other types of studies like that. I know there's one of them is BSF. I don't know if you're all familiar with BSF. And I know there's others, but I don't know the details about all of them. But I found this type of inductive study to be what I was after for a couple reasons. First, like I said, you're studying Scripture directly. You're interpreting God's Word yourself using various tools to bring understanding, especially to difficult passages. You see the interlinking in the books of the Bible because you're doing cross-references all the time. There's a start and a finish to the lesson, which was important because some of the Bible studies, the small group Bible studies we do, it's like you got there at 6 o'clock. It's like, when are we going home? It's midnight already, you know? So, and the studies cause you to really dig into the words so you know that it was says and what it means. And I also felt there's right and wrong interpretations, and we need to know the truth. I think knowing the truth is very important. As John 17 15 through 17 says, "My prayer is not that you take them out of this world, but to keep them from the evil one. They are not of the world, even as I am not of the world. Sanctify them in truth. Your word is truth." And I think that's all that's important that we need to know is the truth. God's word is truth, and we need to know that, and that's what I was after. So, as I said, we switched to the precept. We did that for 20 years, and I find that they are the right thing for me. I felt that I was getting meat, not milk, to use some of the terminology in Hebrews, and I could build my understanding and faith far faster and easier than other unstructured studies that we had been in. They may require homework, yet you get out of them what you put into them. So in 2020, amid the COVID crisis, I retired from the job I had in Singapore, and we moved back here to Savannah. You say, why Savannah? Our son and his family were here, so two grandkids here. And I like boats and water sports. What better place to be for boats and water sports than right here? So it was just a really nice fit. And that fit was amplified when we searched for a church and found CCA. So we went online and said, is there the correct Anglican church in Savannah for us? And we looked and looked and looked, and I ran across CCA, read all about what happened, read about the move out of the original building to the Presbyterian church and so on and so forth. I said, this is the right place for us. They speak the word. They speak the right word. So that was really a big help in helping us decide to come to Savannah just to see that right away. And what I can say is between the church here, St. George's in Singapore, we attended Anglican church in Arusha, Tanzania. We attended the Anglican church in Denver, Colorado. So we've been kind of around the world a little bit. It's nice to be Anglican because, you know what, while it might be a little bit different order here and there, the words, the liturgy, the ceremony, the whole thing is the same. And so I was used to it. I felt comfortable with it. It was easy to get right into it and go. So no matter where you were, the service was familiar. So in a conclusion for this, a couple of points that I think were important to me. Michelle and others, through their persistence, saved my life by not giving up on me. Well, actually, the Lord saved my life, but their persistence is what moved me that direction, okay? So I think persistence in what we do is really important. Don't give up. We don't know the impact we might have on people, and it may not be immediate. It may be something that happens a long time from now. And I especially remember this in teaching the high school kids. You know, you didn't necessarily see anything right there in the high school kids, because sometimes they're like this, you know. They had a late night before. You didn't know if you're penetrating. But now, 38 years, 40 years later, I know some of these kids. And you know what? They're good kids. Solid Christian foundation. So, again, I don't know that that was me. It could have been a multitude of things. But to see it is really, it makes you feel good that you did something worthwhile and you were helpful in that. Second thing I'd say is wives don't give up on husbands. Unfortunately, there's no wives here, but husbands come around, and it's my experience that generally wives attend the church, get involved in the groups, and the husbands are kind of standing on the fringes and not really involved. And I would say that wives, don't give up on your husbands. Be persistent. They'll come around. That's what happened to me, okay? The welcome newcomers have at a church is an important aspect of their continuation. If they step in, they feel welcome, they will be there. I think you all know that and see that all around. The Lord works in our life no matter if we are aware or not. I can see now at 63, I can step back and see the Lord did various things in my life as I was living it. I didn't know that it was the Lord doing it. I had no concept of that. But these coincidences just can't happen like that. There's too many coincidences that come together to be a coincidence. So it had to be the Lord's hand in moving things along. Small groups, men's groups, women's groups are an important part of the church. They keep people in the church and promote more direct study, learning, and build fellowship. And in addition to building the fellowship, they bring groups together that could be of service to the church. Fred, as you were speaking about for this group here. And I also think that structured studies focusing on the word directly are effective in building knowledge, but more importantly, faith, as they show God's truth. And when we get to God's truth, I think that's what builds our faith in a solid and a quick manner. So those are some of the things I found along the ways. I tried to get some 40-minute Bible study books just to share with everybody here so you can see what some of these structured studies are about. Unfortunately, they didn't make it in time in the mail. I couldn't get them in time. But there are many different types of studies you can do like that. As it happens, Michelle and I right now are doing a study on Hebrews. And Hebrews, for me, the first time I read through it, is a very, very difficult book to understand. First, we don't know who wrote it. You know, we're still trying to search for that. But when you read through it, you really have to study it hard. But the Bible study that we're doing right now happens to be a precept study. Breaks it down. So the first three times we meet weekly doing this. The first three times we meet, we're just reading it through, reading it through, reading it through. And then we're trying to find what is the theme of each chapter. And for the first time, we've just completed week three. For the first time, I'm beginning to get the themes all aligned. And now that I have the themes all aligned, I'm beginning to get a picture of what the whole book content is. And I think that's a very valuable experience for me and maybe for others. But it helps me to really see what's in the Word and not what somebody else tells me is in the Word. You know, some commentary or something of that nature. So, one final thought. You might ask, what is God's purpose in sending me to Singapore? Well, I'm not exactly 100% sure, even to this date. I don't know for sure. But there are a few things. First, I feel my life was saved and it drew me into the kingdom of God. That's probably the most important for me. I think secondly, my growing up in the Word in Singapore changed my personality, changed the way I did things, changed the way I interacted with people, and people I worked with noticed this. And would ask occasionally, why are you doing that? Why are you like this? So I become a Christian. I understand. I read the Bible. I understand what it says. I try to live according to it. So that's the second thing. There's an impact on others around us. And in Singapore, the vast number of Singaporeans are not Christian, Buddhist, Hindu, Taoist, and no religion at all are the biggest things that you see there. So there are people that ask questions, and we saw some start to drift toward Christianity and so on and so forth, which I think was very important. So those are the two reasons that I feel that we were sent to Singapore. There may be others that I will discover later on in my life, but for right now, that's what we see. So our time in Singapore was a very interesting time. Most expatriates that go to Singapore usually end up in sales and things like this, and so they travel all the time. I was over there running engineering, quality, and manufacturing, so I was basically in Singapore all the time, so the home life was like a normal home life. In other words, the father wasn't gone all the time. But the one interesting thing about it is, as an engineer, when I designed new equipment to go out for the first time, usually I would go out and install it the first time around. Well, as you know from the oil field, you know, there's oil wells in the most obscure places in the world, and that's where I went to get to those wells. So I traveled to some very unusual places. Sakhalin Islands, for instance, off the east coast of Russia. And so the Sakhalin Islands used to be a prison system, if you will, but it's been opened up, and there's drilling in the north end of the Sakhalin Islands. So traveling there is a bit of an issue. You have to fly into South Korea to Incheon, and from Incheon you come into Yuznov in the Sakhalin Islands. Then you take a train for 16 hours up to the top of the island chain, and then you take a helicopter to the rig location, because where the train ends, where the rig is drilling, there's another 30 or 40 miles of marsh and swamp. And if it's not wintertime, the only way to get there is by helicopter, because the roads are ice roads, if you will, when it's wintertime, but the rest of the time it's just marsh and mud bogs and so on and so forth. So everywhere from places like that to obscure little tiny towns in Australia, and going offshore from them. So in one place we went offshore, the heliport that we go is in the middle of a campground. So you take a bus or a train to this campground, you get on a helicopter, and I mean when I say in the middle of it, it is literally in the middle of the campground. And the helicopter takes off, everybody has to hold their tents down and their covers down, they're all blow away and so on. And you go offshore to the rig or wherever you're going and so on. So a lot of interesting places to travel. But in all of those places, you would go, you would take your personality with you, you would take your Christian being with you, and operate effectively in that manner. And I hope that in doing that, I had a chance to influence people all over Southeast Asia. Don't know that I did, but it was my hope that I did.
Thank you.
Okay? Yes. Any questions? I'm open to any questions about the time, so.
Just a comment. One thing, I met you and your wife when you first came here. I remember I was standing there with Father Craig. And correct me if I'm wrong, it didn't take y'all but a month or two before you started a small group on Wilmington Island.
That's about right. Yep.
I came to Christ in a small group. Mm-hmm. And if you've never been a part of one, it's a very important thing in the church. I think you testify to it, but it can change your life if you're...
Yeah, you know, it doesn't take away from the sermons that are delivered in church, but it gives you the opportunity to really go in and look at the bigger picture that you don't have the time for in the sermon. You have a sermon, you're limited to 20, 25 minutes, where we can take 4 weeks to go through that same passage and study it in depth. Was that 20?
Are you saying you want me to preach longer?
I'm making no comments about the length of sermons. don't give me that. But, Paul, you're right. I felt that the small groups were really effective in doing that.
And there are several in this church, and hopefully there'll be more, but if you're looking for something, you might give it a try.
Yeah. Yes, Sam?
Some of us over the years noticed that our congregation was... And I think you noticed it had a very welcoming spirit. We are legitimately and truly glad to see anybody who walks in that door and will spend time with us. So the front door of this congregation for years has been wide open. Unfortunately, with our congregation and with many other congregations, the back door is also wide open. Small groups close the back Christians.
You're right. You are exactly right.
Exactly.
Yeah. They keep people involved in a group. And if you're involved in a group and that group is going to CCA, you're inclined to go because that's the group you're in. You're exactly right. Yeah.
Craig can't notice all my bad moods or when I'm feeling bad, but I guarantee you the members of my small group will notice something and they'll say, what's going on?
Yeah. Well, the other thing about small groups is when you're new to a church and you come in and you don't know people there, if you get involved with a small group, pretty soon you do know people there. And they come up and see you, or you sit with them, or whatever the case may be. And it just provides that lubricant, that grease, to get people into the seat, to get them involved, and to keep them there. But you're right, a small group does close the back door.
Particularly if you're focused on the Word.
Yeah. Yes, Josh.
Well, thank you very much for sharing that. There were a lot of things that I related to, and I was really glad to hear you open up. I was going to selfishly, or not selfishly, but just plug, speaking of things that are like small groups, if everybody doesn't know, on Monday and Tuesday mornings now, 7:30 at Coffee Deli, we have a men's coffee, and it's kind of a small group. You can kind of come and go. Not everybody makes it every week, but we discuss the gospel lectionary reading, and that's usually our topic of discussion. We go on tangents too, and then we pray for each other, and that's it. And I think Father Craig had said the more it grows, the more we'll just start other mornings. So if Tuesday or Monday is not your favorite, come and grab a few guys and steal away to a Thursday morning or something.
And we're there for an hour, and then a lot of people go to work or
whatever. Yeah.
One thing I didn't address in here that I just expand on a little bit. During our time in Singapore and at St. George's is very much a missionary sending church as well. Through St. George's, we were the first church to have to open up into Cambodia. Remember the killing fields and all that kind of stuff? We had a guy up there, Don Cormack, who was there when that happened. He escaped. He stayed in Singapore at St. George's until that all was resolved. And then the government, I can't remember, the Prince Sihanouk, I think was his name, invited him back to restart the Christian church in Cambodia. So St. George's did that. We purchased the facility for them in Phnom Penh to get started with. We also did missionary work into Laos and into Vietnam and into Nepal. So we had a lot out there. And the missionary groups we had, because we were close enough there, members of the congregation were encouraged to go help. And so we had the opportunity to go to Cambodia, to go to Laos, to go to Nepal, and help out in the missionary work up there. That was a unique experience. You come back from doing that, you're a changed person. You look at things differently, you see things different, you participate differently, and so on and so forth. And that was a great thing for both Michelle and I to go do that sort of thing. When we were in Cambodia, we spent almost 2 weeks in Cambodia. And I'm not a preacher, but I'm a builder. So the missionary work that I did was I rebuilt parts of the house. I put up a basketball court. I repaired cars and did all kinds of things to support the missionaries in their work. They needed things done, and we provided the opportunity to get those things done. So it's not always that you have to be the one that can go up and draw alongside somebody and open the word to them. There's a lot of other aspects to missionary work that can be supportive and be helpful to the missionary, so it allows them to go out and do what their calling is. Because not all of us are called in the same manner, as you all know. Some of us are called differently. So we can use the different gifts in different ways of the missions. And we found that very rewarding. The trip to Nepal was also very good, but it was really cold. So really cold. So we weren't prepared for the cold when we went there. They had a cold snap when we were there. The one thing I remember was just so cold. But that was a nice trip to go there. We were involved with the orphanages there as well. Yes, Greg.
The point you make about how you contribute different things based upon your skills is perfectly apples today, because we're going to go out and spread some gravel around. So if you guys have some extra time, gloves, whatever, we got some gravel to move out there. And as soon as we get it done, we're going to home.
Have you put more in there so all the cars are just trapped?
Oh, you put all the metal at the entrance.
You've got to spread to get out.
That's right.
Doug, one of the things that that occurred to me while you were talking relatively early on that I want to ask you specifically about, you mentioned that even before you knew much about Singapore, you felt that God was calling you to Singapore. So the question is, how do you discern when God is calling you to something?
Well, good question. In that particular case, it was just this overwhelming thought or idea in my head that I needed to be in Singapore. And it just didn't go away. It was just always there. And so that's what I discerned as the call to Singapore. It just didn't go away. And then as I saw events happening.
Based on what you've told me, I believe that's before you were a believer.
Yeah.
What about subsequent? What do you listen for when you feel like God is directing you in a certain direction?
In my case, it's more of a push by circumstances. In other words, I may not be so attuned that I hear him clearly, and I think he knows that, so he says, well, yeah, we'll just slap him upside the head and get his attention and push him in that way, and he'll catch on sooner or later. And I think that's what happens in my case. I'm pushed in a way, one way or the other, and I realize, I see what's going on, and then come around to it. Yeah. When it happened, I knew I needed to go to Singapore. In the very beginning, I didn't associate that with the Lord. I realized that later on. That was a calling to go there. Only when I'm more informed, more educated about it, and so on and so forth. But again, many times I have to be pushed really hard because I don't accept things. Because I was late to Christianity. And you hear all these words about Christianity, about this, and you know this means this, and this means that, and you should do this, and you should do that. I'm very much a skeptic on everything. So I'm skeptical about everything. So, you know, you say, oh, they're having a great revival here, and the Lord is here, and they're laughing, and all this kind of stuff. And it's like, yeah, that might be great, but I'm not sure that I believe that. So I want to find out for myself. I want to check it myself to see if that's really what's going on, because I'm not so inclined to believe what somebody might tell me that's happening someplace. So,
thank you.
Okay?
Thank you.
Jim Berger's got a question.
Fred, before we split up, it's great for the way around. COVID, we have